Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
In this program, refugees from Mali now fear hunger more than war.
Actuellement, les gens ne fuient pas la guerre. Ils fuient la misère.
Now people don't fear the fighting that much. They are afraid of hunger. They are afraid of dying from hunger and thirst.
Aujourd'hui, les gens ont venu.
After the revolution in Tunisia, economic problems remain.
Two-thirds of the strikes and sit-ins today are young people who are promised during the campaign that they will get jobs. They never get jobs.
And despite the new international convention, domestic workers still fight for their rights.
I kept on saying, I want to go home to India. I was ready to die. I just couldn't take it anymore.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. In West Africa, around 10 million people face food insecurity. Some experts even put the figure at 18 million in need of assistance. A prolonged drought across the region has caused poor harvests and rising food prices from Senegal to Chad. But in Mali, sparse rainfalls were aggravated by a man-made crisis. In January, Tuareg fighters rekindled a long-simmering rebellion in northern Mali. The violence has led to the displacement of more than 300,000 people, according to the UN Refugee Agency. About half of them found refuge in neighboring countries. Some 60,000 refugees linger in camps in northern Burkina Faso. They told reporter Marine Olivesi how large-scale displacement is feeding into the developing food crisis.
Crowding in what's dubbed the luxury villa of the refugee camp, because it has walls and a nice breeze running through, a group of young and older Tuaregs try to explain their situation. Imagine, they say, if everyone in your town, from your neighbors to the mayor, were all forced to move to another country at around the same time. Well, that's just happened to us. These men are from Intilit, a desert town in North Mali, home to about 30,000 people. When a Tuareg rebellion broke out 4 months ago, most of its residents fled the violence, crossed over the border, and set camp here in northern Burkina Faso. The sheep and camels came too, at least those who didn't get lost on the way. Al-Hader Agazar, a 69-year-old farmer, drove with his children and grandchildren to the camp. A shepherd followed them by foot with the cattle. But one morning, the shepherd woke up and Al-Hader's sheep were gone, all 73 of them.
Il n'y a pas un seul réfugié qui n'a pas subi des pertes en animaux.
Not a single one of the refugees here hasn't lost animals during the journey, whether they're camels or sheep. So many of them got disoriented and we couldn't find them. Others were attacked by jackals or died because of thirst. This is an enormous loss.
Al-Hader explains that losing livestock means they've got less milk to sell or to feed their children with. But it's more than a loss of capital, he says. It's a heartbreak, too.
C'est inhérent à ma vie de Targhi.
As a Tuareg, the cattle is part of my life, of who I am. I'd rather have animals than an actual house.
Turns out he's got neither now. Like most here, Al-Hader fled North Mali for fear of a government crackdown after Tuareg fighters rose up in arms in January. The violence largely subsided after rebels outgunned the military and declared their independence in early April. Yet refugees haven't returned home, and others keep coming.
Actuellement, les gens ne fuient pas la guerre. Ils fuient la misère, la famine.
Now people don't fear the fighting that much. They are afraid of hunger. They are afraid of dying from hunger and thirst.
Aujourd'hui, les gens ont venu.
Poor rain last year caused a crop deficit all around the Sahel region. But in Mali's case, climatic factors were then compounded by political ones. Here's Idoual Agbala, a community leader at the camp.
North Mali is supplied by the south. Now the roads are closed and traders can't sell their crops there. That's why the markets are empty.
Food prices, which were already higher than usual because of the drought, skyrocketed. The cost of millet, the cereal staple in the region, nearly tripled in some places. And people in North Mali can't count on humanitarian aid either. A string of Islamist groups gained ground amidst the chaos and now hold sway over towns like Timbuktu. Idwal explains their presence has created a hostile environment for Western people and hampered relief efforts.
The very people who are supposed to help us are at risk of being kidnapped today, so they stopped coming. NGOs, development partners, expats, they all fled North Mali because of security issues.
While North Mali is mostly off-limits to foreign aid, the World Food Programme and the UN Refugee Agency are trying to help those they can reach. The two organizations launched a $77 million operation to assist the internally displaced in South Mali and refugees in neighboring countries. This should help keep famine at bay for now, but some fear large-scale displacement cripples the entire production system in the long run. Fatoumata Olet Aibala is a wholesaler who's made a business out of lending cereals to farmers during the lean season. She says those who've stayed in her town in North Mali can't feed their livestock now that she's gone.
All the customers I left behind, they won't get any more grain on credit. My business has been put to a halt, and so has their business. I'm one of the only wholesalers who operates like that. Now the lean season has started, and that's when they need me most. If I was still there, I could help them get through it.
The rain season is to begin soon, but the first harvests are still months away. Fatoumata says if she's still a refugee by then, she won't replenish her stocks next fall, so she won't be able to help out cattle breeders during the next hunger gap either. Never, ever in my life have I seen such destabilization, she says. A rebellion on top of a natural disaster, it's like a perfect storm. Marine Olivesi, Deutsche Welle, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
This story was made possible by a reporting grant from the French-American Foundation. Since the recent political upheaval in the Middle East and North Africa, more than 1 million people have fled to neighboring countries. Some European politicians have warned of a flood of refugees coming to Europe, calling for stricter border controls. Yet experts say that there has been no flood to speak of, since only some 50,000 migrants from North Africa have made it to Europe last year, and several thousand have since returned home. Last June, EU politicians passed a resolution to beef up EU security with new border surveillance initiatives. However, a new report commissioned by the German NGO Heinrich Böll Foundation found that the proposed measures are unnecessary, costly, and breach the EU's human rights responsibilities. Cinnamon Nippert has more from Berlin.
Ben Hayes is the project director at Statewatch, a London-based civil liberties organisation, and co-author of the report. He explains the aim of the Eurosur bill, which is currently being debated in the European Parliament.
What the Eurosur proposal envisages doing is interlinking 24 different national border surveillance systems, so all the member states with a sea border, plus sort of seamlessly integrating all these different types of technologies, satellite surveillance, drones, vessel tracking systems, coastal radars. The actual stated sort of technological aim of the legislation is to be able to track any boat anywhere in the Mediterranean headed for Europe.
Hayes and others are calling for an independent assessment of the effectiveness of these surveillance measures. While the EU seems to be following the US example of policing the Mexican border, the United States itself pulled the plug on its Secure Borders initiative in 2010 due to spiralling costs and ineffectiveness. Co-author of the study, Matthias Vermeulen, research fellow at the European University Institute, says that realistically it's impossible to make a watertight border security system, and the EU already has sufficient measures in place.
Especially with the implementation of the visa information system and the rolling out of the new Schengen information system, I think the European Union has enough systems right now to effectively control immigration.
Hayes from Statewatch says that while of course nations have the right to control their borders, he is concerned about the overall direction of the EU's border security policy in relation to migration control.
It's over-reliant on technology, it's militarist in its approach, it's counter to the EU's human rights obligations, and it does nothing to address what is really a humanitarian crisis.
Hayes says that the arrival of refugees by boat is a drop in the ocean and has been used by conservative politicians as a political football.
The truth is that, you know, 25,000 people in a European Union of 350 million is a tiny fraction, and, you know, I'd say that the numbers were cynically exploited by those European politicians who want to appear tough on crime and migration and all the rest of it.
Hayes points out that EU border surveillance and security policies are predicated on trying to prevent migrants and refugees from actually reaching EU territory. Because if they do make it, then the EU has to honour its obligations under the Geneva Conventions. Last year, 1,800 people died trying to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa. Since 1988, over 18,000 people have died trying to get to Europe. Italian journalist and blogger Gabriella Del Grande founded the Fortress Europe website, where he documents these deaths. Each year, 20 to 30,000 refugees and migrants arrive in Italy by boat. At the same time, every year the Italian government asks for 200,000 to 300,000 migrants to come and work.
The idea is not to stop migration, because they are the same government who ask for immigrants every year as a cheap labour. The idea is to control the border.
Scar Keller, member of the European Parliament for the Greens, says such border control policies are indicative of a particular mindset that's focused on attracting highly skilled migrants.
So you create a category of people that we want and people we don't want, and people are useful to us and people are not useful to us. And that, I think, really undermines any sense of humanity on the one hand, but also human rights.
Keller points out that Germany and many other European nations have profited hugely from migrant labour.
Migrants are not threats, they're just people who are looking for a better life.
Europe's Schengen Agreement has eliminated border controls between 25 countries for over 400 million people. But since the recent uprisings, this agreement has come under attack. Despite the fact that we live in a globalised world and freedom of movement is actually listed in the UN Convention on Human Rights, states are still trying to control mobility. Rather than beefing up security measures, Italian journalist Del Grande says it would make more sense to just make it easier for people to enter the EU.
If you give the people the possibility to easily get a visa, you can also impose them to respect the expiration of the visa.
Del Grande from Fortress Europe points out that when people find out that the EU isn't the El Dorado they thought it was, then they have to reassess their situation. Already, almost a fifth of the 25,000 Tunisians who arrived in Italy last year have since returned home.
5,000 or 6,000 of them, they came back to Tunisia because they were looking for a job, they were looking for better opportunity. But with this big crisis that we have in Europe, they didn't find it, and they come back. I mean, human beings, they have a dignity. They can choose what is better for their life.
Due to the financial crisis, hundreds of thousands of migrants across Europe are returning to their home countries.
Look at Greece. Last year, 600,000 Albanians, they left Greece because of the crisis. Spain, 800,000 from Latin America, they left Spain and they went back to the countries. Italy, we don't have official figures, but I can tell you that many friends of mine, they left.
According to Vermeulen and Hayes, authors of the study assessing EU border surveillance initiatives, the cost of these new policies could blow out to over 2 billion euros. Whether Europe can afford to fund such security measures in this time of financial crisis is one question. And then there's the human cost. Ben Hayes from Statewatch.
What we are saying is, look, this is a humanitarian crisis. You know, people are dying every day. The EU needs to look at its obligations towards these people. These are, by and large, you know, migrants and refugees fleeing destitution and poverty, and prioritise saving lives. That doesn't mean you've got to open the borders to everyone who wants to come in.
Eurosur is currently being debated in the European Parliament. Cinema Nippard, Berlin.
Still coming up here on World in Progress, more rights for domestic workers. But first, here's Kathleen Schuster with a look at some development news.
Thai journalist found guilty of insulting royal family. After a long-anticipated verdict, a Thai court has finally handed down an 8-month suspended sentence to online journalist Cherinoch Premchaporn this week. The court also fined her $630. She was accused of failing to take down allegedly slanderous comments about the royal family quickly enough from her newspaper's online forum in 2008. Thailand has a strict anti-defamation law, sentencing insults to the royal family with up to 15 years in prison. Premchaporn's case has led to international protests. 211 UN personnel killed last year. 211 UN personnel were killed in 2011, either through attacks or accidents. That's according to a UN report to commemorate the UN Day of Peacekeepers. The figure includes both UN peacekeeping troops and other UN personnel. Since the first UN observers were sent to Palestine in 1948, the UN uses May 29th to honor UN peacekeepers. Currently, some 120,000 so-called blue helmets serve in 16 missions around the world, most of them in Africa. GroupSphere Maya Biosphere Project on hold. Latin American environmental groups say they have reason to believe that the new Guatemalan administration plans to neglect the country's Maya Biosphere Reserve. Four national parks and three wildlife reserves lie within the tropical region, as well as numerous Mayan archaeological sites. But ever since President Molina took office in January, environmental groups claim that no progress has been made. Morocco still employs underage domestic servants. Morocco's planning ministry says that 30,000 children in the country still work as domestic servants. The previous government had been trying to eliminate this practice by drafting a law, but Parliament has failed to pass it so far. In 2008, the International Labour Organization, ILO, estimated that worldwide, 7.4 million children between the ages of 5 and 14 were forced to work as domestic servants. Under Morocco's proposed law, violators would face prison sentences and large fines.
That was Kathleen Schuster with a look at some development news. In June 2011, the member states of the International Labour Organization signed a convention on domestic workers' rights. It marked a major breakthrough in the protection of domestic workers who have long been excluded from existing labour laws and are often subjected to abuse. Globally, they make up about 7% of the workforce. The vast majority are women and girls, and many of them migrant workers. The new convention guarantees the same basic rights as those available to other workers, including weekly days off, minimum wages and social security. The parliaments of the Philippines and Uruguay have just passed the convention, and others are set to follow. But it's a long uphill struggle, as Naomi Conrad reports from India.
If you know the desired extension, please dial it now. 5, labor complaints. 6.
Please wait a moment.
It's mid-afternoon in Oman, and the Indian Embassy's labor welfare unit's telephone lines are busy. It takes several long minutes on hold to reach the welfare officer who deals with any complaints from the roughly 700,000 Indians living and working in the Gulf state. While the officer is unwilling to say just how many labour complaints reach the embassy every day, he stresses that they are dealt with immediately.
Normally, people come here in the embassy, so we take their complaint. There's a prescribed form for that.
If the dispute can't be resolved with the employer, it's taken to an Omani court, he adds, and there is a 24-hour helpline. When Aisha Tien was working in Oman in 2003, there was no one to help her. The Indian woman from Kerala was imprisoned in her employer's house without access to a mobile phone. She didn't even know which village she was staying in. She had left her home high up in the mountain range of southern India to find a job that would pay enough to feed her children and her sick husband. In Oman, she made 60 euros a month, enough to keep her family afloat. Yet after 8 months of grueling work, the then 40-year-old went on hunger strike.
I didn't leave my room for 2 days. I kept on saying, I want to go home to India. I was ready to die. I just couldn't take it anymore.
Aisha's employer, a rich Omani businessman, rushed into her dingy lean-to made of rough plywood and cardboard, hidden from sight under his huge mahogany staircase. He stood over her worn mattress, threatening to beat her with a stick if she didn't get up. His wives and children looked on impassively, she says.
Everything was so awful. But the worst thing was that I had to work so hard. I didn't even have the time to eat.
Aisha was forced to work from 4 a.m. until late at night, cleaning, cooking and looking after her employer's cows. She used to cry herself to sleep every night. Conservative estimates put the number of domestic workers worldwide at over 50 million, but the actual figure may be around 100 million or more. Up to a third of them are children, and the vast majority, more than 80%, are women. And many of them, like Aisha, face abuse.
In some countries, domestic work is still considered close to domestic servitude.
Martin Oetz works for the International Labour Organization that passed the Convention for the Protection of Domestic Workers last year. It guarantees minimum standards, such as weekly days off, limits on working hours, social security and the protection against abuse. It's a huge step, Oetz says, considering that for many years domestic workers in most countries lacked any kind of protection.
Even in countries that have developed labor law systems, domestic workers were often considered not really as workers and they were excluded from existing labor laws, or they were covered by labor laws that were less favorable than those enjoyed by other workers.
Trade unions were slow to take up the fight. Many domestic workers are migrants who often face racism. Like Aisha, they often don't speak the local language. Many live in their employer's house, making it difficult to meet, let alone become organized. Add to that entrenched gender discrimination, and it's not hard to see why it took so long for countries and campaigners to take notice of the plight of many domestic workers. Nisha Varia from Human Rights Watch says. She has campaigned for domestic workers' rights for over a decade. But in the last 5 years, things have begun to change, Varia says. She points at the drafting of the ILO Convention, which dates back to 2008 and involved employers' unions, governments and workers' unions, including newly formed domestic workers' alliances.
For the last few years, we've actually seen some concrete changes on the ground. There are many countries already changing their national legislation to be in compliance with the convention. For example, the Philippines, Vietnam, Morocco, many of these countries have draft legislation and they are looking to the standards in the ILO convention.
While the ILO member states are under no legal obligation to ratify the convention, many are planning to do so. The parliaments of both the Philippines and Uruguay have passed the convention and Varia is convinced that others will follow soon. Sitting outside her son's small house, Aisha recalls that she cried when she got back to India. She was so relieved to be home. What would she say to women who are considering working abroad?
If you're young, don't go. Don't ruin your life. But if you're old and have a family support, well, you don't have a choice, do you?
Naomi Conrad, DW, India.
And our last story today takes us to Tunisia, which was the first country to overthrow its dictatorship, helping spark uprisings throughout the Arab world. But today, demonstrators are back in the streets, saying the new government hasn't met their economic needs. Riz Ehrlich reports from the town where the uprising began, Sidi Bouzid, Tunisia.
Dozens of demonstrators are rallying in front of the town hall in the city of Sidi Bouzid. In December 2010, a street vendor burned himself to death at this very location. His death sparked mass protests across Tunisia, the ouster of the country's dictator, and eventually uprisings throughout the Arab world. The demonstrators at Sidi Bouzid City Hall are demanding jobs.
They are asking for their right of a job, of having a work peacefully.
Nothing is being changed. We're just struggling in the same situation. I have got master degree in English language, and I'm still unemployed for 5 years.
The call to prayer echoes through the streets of this hardscrabble city. Islam has deep roots here, and it's reflected in politics. The Islamist Ennahda Party has benefited from the fall of the regime. It won the most seats in last October's election to the Constituent Assembly, tasked with writing the country's new constitution. Mohamed Soukri, a local leader of Ennahda, blames the current economic instability on anti-government agitators.
leftists and the old ruling party instigate these demonstrations. They will support any social movement against the government. There are a small number of people representing those parties who lost the elections. They don't represent the people.
But economist and banker Shedley Ayari says the economic discontent is widespread and real, particularly among recent college graduates.
Two-thirds of the strikes and sit-ins today are by people, young people, who are promised during the campaign for the election of this Assemblée Constituante that they will get jobs. They never get jobs.
Tunisian unemployment is estimated to be 19%. Ennahda has only been in power since January, and its leaders say they need more time to repair the economy. Saeed Ferjani is a member of the Ennahda Political Bureau in Tunis. The government, he says, is beset by ultra-conservative Islamists on the one side and leftist unions on the other.
We have to restructure an economy which has failed the people for more than half a century. So we cannot do it in 100 days. We need more time, and we need some kind of stability. Some of the people, they are trying really to stir trouble in order to do not let the government do or succeed.
Ferjani says his government is encouraging foreign investment to generate jobs and has recently accepted financial aid from the U.S. to reduce its budget deficit.
We have to diversify our relationship, to strengthen our relationship with the U.S. in particular, with the EU as well, and with the West. We are proud of this relationship with the U.S. Yes, we may or might disagree in a few things, whether about the issue of Palestine and Israel and so on. We told them that let's agree to disagree.
Sitting at a Tunis cafe, Lina Benmani strongly disagrees. She criticizes Tunisia's growing alliance with the U.S. The activist blogger and university lecturer says the U.S. opportunistically supports Tunisia's new government after years of supporting the brutal dictatorship of Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali.
U.S. doesn't care about Tunisians, doesn't care about people, and doesn't care about human rights. They were aware of the oppression under which we were living, and they were closing their eyes on it because they had economic interests and other interests with Ben Ali and its regime. Now they are doing the same with another party.
The government faces serious economic challenges in the years ahead.
Before the elections, they gave many, many promises to Tunisians. Now they are not working on fulfilling these promises. Diverted the attention of people towards fake debates about identity, religion, and whatever. We don't see any willingness to change the situation to improve it. Okay, they say that we have to give them time, but they didn't even give plans or programs. There is nothing.
Back at the Sidi Bouzid City Hall, this protester says the Tunisian revolution isn't over yet.
The system, the same system of Ben Ali, is still running in the veins of this government. We want new blood, we want a new system, we want a new things.
Tunisia has scheduled parliamentary and presidential elections in 1 year. Until then, say analysts, political turmoil and economic instability may well continue. For DW, I'm Reese Ehrlich, Sidi Bouzid, Tunisia.
And that report from Tunisia wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for tuning in today. For more information on globalization and development issues, go to our website at dw.de/globalization. You can also listen to World in Progress reports online or download the show as podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time with a new edition. On behalf of today's studio team here in Bonn, Nigel Tandy and Marion Kulina, I'm your host Anke Rasper, saying thanks for listening and goodbye.